I love my morning coffee, but sometimes the crash hits harder than the caffeine. That's when I switch to Everyday Dose, coffee with benefits. It's real coffee infused with mushrooms, collagen, and nootropics, giving me smooth, focused energy that actually lasts. The Black Friday sale is on. Get 61% off your first coffee plus starter kit, a free A2 probiotic creamer, and over $100 in free gifts. Enter for a chance to win $100 cash or even get your entire order refunded. Head to everydaydose.com/podcast or use code podcast at checkout.
Welcome to SI's Planet Football Podcast, where each week we discuss the latest in the world of soccer. I am SI.com soccer editor Avi Krediter, joined today by SI senior writer Grant Wall, SI.com's Brian Strauss. A little later on, we have an interview, Grant, that you were able to do with Angus McNabb, a vice president at Opta, the soccer data provider. But guys, first, I want to start with some Copa America talk, more specifically what happened this week with Giovanni Dos Santos. It was one of the more bizarre roster snub situations because it happened while he was in the midst of a media tour organized, pre-organized for this time. And both of you spoke to him during this time. Brian, you got him a little bit before the roster came out, and Grant, you had him on XM Radio as the roster came out. Brian, I want to start with you. We'll go chronologically here. You know, when a media tour is organized for a player like this, you assume it's because something good is about to happen to him. And it was weird. He just wouldn't talk about Mexico's team. He made it seem like he had no idea what was going on, right?
Yeah, it's one of the more, I mean, we've all been doing this a long time, and it was one of the more bizarre experiences I've had dealing with PR reps and a player. The timing was baffling. Their apparent ignorance of the timing was baffling. And then this whole thing that came out later that Gio somehow snubbed an invitation to play in this tournament is baffling. So it's tough to draw any conclusions when I'm so confused. You know, he got on the phone with a couple PR reps, and I started asking about Copa, and the woman who was working with him said, well, we're not here to, you know, we're not here to talk about Mexico or the Copa roster. And I was kind of like, well, then why are you here? Why are we doing this now? Well, we can talk about the Galaxy. We can talk about the Mexican national team, you know, in the big picture. And I said, well, the roster's coming out tonight. And it was about 6 p.m. Eastern. I didn't know exactly, but I knew it was coming out. And the woman said, no, it's not. It's coming out on the 20th. And then Gio interrupts her and says, no, it's tonight. It's tonight. So I credit him for that. But yeah, no, he wouldn't go into details, wouldn't talk about it, talked about how the Copa was a great tournament, talked about, you know, said he looks forward to playing with Mexico. We chatted about some other things. But I got off the phone with him still, 20-minute conversation, having no idea whether or not he was going to be in the tournament.
So bizarre. And then Grant, as he found out, you had him on air.
Literally as the Mexico press conference with Coach Juan Carlos Osorio was taking place and the information was being released publicly that Giovanni Dos Santos was not on the team and, according to Osorio, had turned down an invitation to play on the Copa America team, we're on live radio on Sirius XM with Giovanni Dos Santos. And I imagined it was for Head and Shoulders. It was a PR thing he was doing. I imagined the Head and Shoulders rep just guzzling whiskey after this, or maybe even while this was happening, because
or guzzling Head and Shoulders.
This podcast not to be sponsored in the future by Head and Shoulders, by the way, but it was just a crazy situation. And I'm on with Steve Cangelosi on Sirius, and his first question is, Gio, do you know if you're on the team? And the response is, nope, silence, which, by the way, not true. And then my question is, well, I'm following this right now, and it has been released, and you're not on the roster, and Osorio is saying that you turned down an invitation. Is that true? Quiet, silence. I'd rather not talk about the national team.
So awkward.
In some ways, I came out of it saying this is either the best live interview I've ever done or the worst, or maybe a little bit of both. It is baffling to me that Giovanni Dos Santos would turn down an invitation to play In the Copa America. This is something that is taking place in the United States where he plays. It's being promoted by Major League Soccer and Soccer United Marketing, which I'm sure is not thrilled at all that he has turned down the invitation, if that is in fact the case. It sounds like it is. That's crazy. You know, he's one of the most famous Mexican players, and I'm sure would help sell tickets. Now, will Mexico still sell a lot of tickets? Yes. Will they still have a chance to win this tournament? Yes, in my opinion. Carlos Vela is not on this team as well. And so we're kind of going back to the days of, when there was this kind of running telenovela between coach and players on the Mexican national team. Now, Vela has not really played that well this year, so I don't think he would have even started in this tournament. And Chicharito has been fantastic. Andres Guardado's on this team. There's lots to like on this Mexico team, but we're back in the soap opera stage.
And it's just...
Gio was also, Gio told me, he was kind of, not bragging, that's a bit of a strong word, but he was pretty proud of the fact that Mexico feels like a home team when it plays in the U.S. I mean, he made that point. And so, just to follow up on what Grant was saying about, you know, organizers and people here not being thrilled about this, that's exactly why.
Yeah, the whole thing is just weird to me. And it's not like he hasn't played well. He's been in such good form recently for L.A. I think he's got goals in four of his last five games. There's the whole little bit about Juan Carlos Osorio being a little peeved that he's playing in MLS, which is also weird because Osorio used to coach in MLS. The whole thing, there's just so many twists and turns. It's like a Choose Your Adventure book. But in any event, Giovanni Dos Santos will not be at Copa America this summer. Maybe the Olympics as an overage player again.
Pretty doubtful considering his current relationship with the national team program.
Perhaps not then.
But his hair has body and look.
Perfect. Speaking of Dos Santos and MLS, we're taping this on Thursday. The one of the two times a year that the MLS Players Union puts out its list of player salaries. It's not gospel. There are a lot of factors that go into these numbers that that aren't reflected in the final tally. But Dos Santos, in guaranteed compensation, one of the top 10 earners in the league, $4.25 million this season. Guys, I kind of want to go around, you know, the millionaires club, if you will, and get your take on guys who might be a little overpaid, guys who might be a little underpaid, or guys who are properly rated. Grant, let's start with Frank Lampard, six mil. Hasn't played a minute this season. What do you think?
Terribly, horribly overpaid. I'm trying to think of a different adverb. We have a discussion later here with Gus McNabb about analytics, and I do ask him if there's a way kind of using analytics to find out if Frank Lampard is the worst signing in the history of MLS. Can we use them to compare his lack of performance to, say, Rafa Marquez? So look for that later on here. Supposedly Frank Lampard has a chance to play this weekend in the New York City Derby. I'm not getting my hopes up too high, to be honest. Very overpaid.
Everyone likes a good redemption story. Thing is, NYCFC is doing fine with them at this point. Brian, the top two guys in the league, Kaká and Sebastian Giovinco. Kaká still the highest in guaranteed compensation by just a bit. Your thoughts on the top?
Kaká is overpaid. He's got two goals and two assists. He wasn't able to take Orlando to the playoffs last year. He's in and out of the lineup, and he has. There are questions about how much power he has there, and how, you know, and we've seen a lot of changeover in that club, and a lot of speculation about who's running the show there and where things are going. And, you know, Kaká's a great ambassador for the league. He's a nice guy. But he has a lot of control over that club, and that's not always a great thing. Obviously, Giovinco's worth every Canadian cent and every loony that goes his way. He's spectacular. And Toronto's a favorite in the East, largely because of his performance. So, Giovinco earns every penny. Kaká, I think the jury's still out.
Grant, a little below Giovinco, his teammate, Michael Bradley, $6.5 million. Guaranteed compensation, the highest paid American player in MLS. Behind him, Jozy Altidor, $4.825 million, and Clint Dempsey, $4.6 million. And then Tim Howard comes in at a hefty $2.6 million. coming into the Colorado Rapids. What's your take on the top echelon of the U.S. men's national team players?
Well, first off, let me say that I think it's great that American players can be among the top 10 earners in MLS, because that hasn't always been the case. And you can play in your home country and still make a ton of money. In fact, you can be overpaid in your entire or in your own country. That's part of the reason that they were able to sign Michael Bradley and Clint Dempsey and Jozy Altidore, was that at that stage of their career, when they were still basically in their primes, MLS offered more money to them, quite a bit more than the world market was willing to pay them. And so by definition, I guess you could say that's overpaying the world market. Now, if Michael Bradley can help fill the stadium in Toronto and lead them to an MLS championship this year, and I think they're actually kind of in a good spot to do that potentially, then I think he's properly paid, even at $6.5 million. You know, Jozy Altidore right now is not nearly as productive as Sebastian Giovinco. He's injured again. He's been injured a lot. And so you'd have to say he's overpaid right now. But like I said, basically all these Americans are overpaid. Tim Howard, even at $2.5 million, would not get that much on the world market. But that, in a sense, is what MLS knows they have to do to get these guys into the league. You know, Clint Dempsey, you know, it's important for him to get Seattle to an MLS Cup final and win this year. So that's kind of where we are right now. I'm glad U.S. players are getting paid.
Absolutely. And if you haven't had a chance yet, read Brian's feature on Clint Dempsey on our website, Planet Football. Good stuff ahead of Copa America. Just wrapping up on this, and then we'll move on. Robbie Keane, who some might say, I would argue, is the best DP signing, foreign signing in MLS history, $3.5 million. That seems like a relative bargain when you take into account the fact that his teammate Steven Gerrard is at $6.1 million. That to me stands out. He has been worth every dime that that the Galaxy have paid him. It's always interesting time seeing these salaries come out. Again, it's not gospel, but it is a good reference and it is a good guide.
I think what I would say also too is that it's always kind of awkward having these discussions, because MLS is still at a stage of its development that putting butts in seats is a big part of what somebody gets paid if you're a big star. And so Steven Gerrard looks like he's making a ridiculous amount of money, Kaká, and yet, you know, especially Kaká, I think, does put butts in seats. Steven Gerrard theoretically should put butts in seats, but I don't know if he does. Frank Lampard, same thing. So MLS hasn't gotten yet to the point where it's all about on the field production, but Robbie Keane, man, underpaid.
Yeah, when you take into account everybody else, absolutely. Let's go back over the pond now. A lot of domestic cup finals this weekend. In fact, all the five big leagues, they'll all have their domestic cup finals being played on Saturday and Sunday, now that the league seasons are over. Grant and Brian, I just kind of wanted to get your thoughts on each of them and see who you thought might go ahead and lift some silverware this weekend. Brian, let's start with you in the FA Cup, Manchester United and mighty Crystal Palace. What is Man United going to end with a happy Louis van Gaal?
It would be a totally appropriate conclusion to this bonkers English season if a club that has never won a major honor like Crystal Palace beats the mighty Man United in the FA Cup final. So I'm sure there are an uncountable number of neutrals who would love to see that happen. It's impossible to follow the Van Gaal saga at Man United. He's in, he's out. He has support, he doesn't. Obviously they've got some exciting young players like Martial and Ashford that are fun to watch, but this team is just turgid. They look uninspired. With the specter of Mourinho is looming over it all. So maybe he's coaching for his job on Saturday. Maybe he's not. But I think, like I said, in this season of strange occurrences and underdogs and Cinderella stories, why not Crystal Palace? You know, why not a club that's sort of been mediocre for so many decades to come in and have this wonderful moment? It would be a fitting way to end things.
Can't wait for the Leicester City Crystal Palace Community Shield. That's gonna be fantastic.
Exactly. No, that would be fantastic. Right, perfect symbol. It'd be great.
Grant, in Germany, Bayern Dortmund. I think for me, it's the choice match of the weekend. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, on paper, this is the two heavyweight teams of Germany, which we're not necessarily seeing in the other cup finals in Europe this weekend, and also with an American flavor too. If Christian Pulisic gets a chance to be in the 18 and potentially play in this game, that would be kind of cool. It's Pep Guardiola's last game at Bayern Munich, and it's interesting because it's like, of all the trophies, the least important of, you know, Champions League and domestic league, but it does maybe have an impact on just, you know, his final moments with the club. And, you know, you look at these two teams and how they played against each other this year, and Bayern Munich has had the advantage whenever they have played, but clearly Dortmund is capable of beating Bayern in this game. And I like what Thomas Tuchel has done at Dortmund. So, yeah, it'd be cool to see an American Pulisic win a trophy, and I kind of like him to stay healthy at least before Copa America starts and he joins the team.
That would be nice. There's also the awkward plot twist of Mats Hummels going from Dortmund to Bayern. Who's he playing for this weekend? Let's find out. Brian, in Spain, Barcelona and Sevilla. Sevilla, the three-peat of Europa League titles, playing for the Copa del Rey. This is, you would think Barcelona's to lose, yeah?
Yeah, you'd think, but Sevilla has proven their mettle in cup competition, obviously. Not only the three straight Europa League titles, but they won the Copa del Rey in 2010 and 2007, so sort of during this reign of Barcelona dominance, while they haven't really contested the league, for the league title, they've popped up now and then and won the Copa del Rey. So it's beautiful soccer. The you know, Spain's domination in Europe says everything you need to know about how good the top of La Liga is, and I'm looking forward to it. And obviously Barcelona, after falling short in the Champions League, you know, the consolation of a domestic double will at least do something to placate the club and their fans. So this is the one I'm looking forward to this weekend. Understanding the drama of Palace and the drama of Bayern Dortmund and PSG Marseille and the rivalries like that, I'm looking forward to the Copa del Rey.
And this will also be the last action that Messi and Suarez will have before going to their national teams for Copa America. So we'll see how they hopefully come through unscathed, of course. Organizers are crossing their fingers, and then we'll come to the States. Grant, in Italy, Juventus and Milan, what's a nice way to put this? It should be a bigger game than it is. Juventus has just been so dominant in Milan, so down. It's just not as powerful a matchup anymore.
AC Milan fans are really, really angry right now at the direction of the club. They're angry at Silvio Berlusconi. They're angry at how they've basically started over every July the last 3 years and figure to be doing that again. And maybe they'll finally get bought soon. By, I guess it looks like a Chinese group is the most likely scenario, and we'll start seeing the old AC Milan again. But for right now, the new AC Milan, the modern AC Milan, is not very impressive. Yet, they have made it to the final here. And so there's going to be some mixed feelings even from AC Milan fans if they were to win this, because I think they want to see changes so badly. They don't want there to be any sort of indication that, oh, you're doing okay, because they're not doing okay. And I don't think they need to worry, in a sense, because I think Juventus is going to win this game. Juventus has been by far the best team in Italy this season. Once again, crazy things can happen in one game, but I like Juve.
It will be tough to say for soccer to say goodbye to the Italian Trump, won't it?
Not really.
This is an amazing statistic. I looked this up. AC Milan, this is AC Milan we're talking about, has won only one domestic trophy in the past 12 years. They won the 2000, and I mean Liga Cup. They've won the Liga Cup only once in the past 12 years. That's astonishing for a club that we just sort of instinctively put among the best in the world.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's absolutely crazy. And Juventus, I think, went like 24-0-1 in its last 25 league games to win their fifth straight title. Just stupid statistics, and it's just really indicative of how powerful they've been in Serie A. Brian, let's wrap up with the man who knows something or two about classic exits, our boy Zlatan, PSG and Marseille. In his last league game, he walked off the field. PSG had already used his three substitutes. He walked off the field with his kids with 3 minutes to go in the game. Do you see him lifting a trophy in his final game with PSG?
Yeah, I mean, he PSG is dominant. I mean, they're going for their second straight domestic treble. Yeah. France has a League Cup as well. That's ridiculous. They had the league title sewn up, it seemed, by New Year's. You know, he is a legend. He told us himself. So why not walk off? I just want to add this. The French Cup is awesome. It is an amazing competition. So we assume that the FA Cup is this all-inclusive, every pub team and weekend league team gets to enter. The FA Cup has 800 entries each year, give or take. The French Cup has 8,000.
Are you serious? 8,000
teams get to enter the French Cup. And it basically takes 2 years to do, because those 8,000, you know, the 2017 French Cup is starting now, like in Martinique and stuff. It's an awesome tournament. And I like the fact, you know, that you go from 8,000 to two and or to one, who will be PSG. But it's very cool.
I hope L'Équipe actually prints a full bracket at some point.
The 8,000 team bracket. If they're not, we should. That's a great opportunity. Fantastic. Well, a lot of great soccer this weekend for sure. Just because the league seasons are over does not mean that that the good club soccer has ended as well. And of course, next weekend, the Champions League final, which we'll talk about absolutely next week. But
none of this matters. None of this matters in comparison to the Wednesday Hull City promotion playoff.
You're right.
It is the biggest game in the world on May 28th.
In terms of profit, yes.
Sheffield Wednesday, 90 minutes away from the Premier League.
Unabashed Sheffield Wednesday supporter, Brian Strauss. Can we say that?
Absolutely. Proving. I'm ready.
Well, we wish you luck next week. Before we get to all of that, though, Grant, you have a fascinating talk with Angus McNabb from Opta. A lot of things that you can learn from this. So we'll take a quick break and then come back with that. On the SI Media Podcast, Richard Deitch welcomes five-time NBA All-Star and TNT broadcaster Chris Webber. Hear stories of Webber's incredible run with the Fab Five at Michigan, his career in the pros, and now a new life in broadcasting. That's the SI Media Podcast, hosted by Richard Deitch. Find it at si.com/podcasts or your favorite podcast app of choice, including iTunes, Stitcher, and now Google Play Music. No podcast covers the NBA Conference Finals quite like SI Open Floor with Andrew Sharp and Ben Golliver. Let's say you get up early for work and you can't stay up late to watch Steph Curry take on KD. No problem. Our guys are watching every minute and then producing a podcast that'll be ready for your commute in the morning. That's Open Floor, SI's NBA podcast. Find it at si.com/podcasts or your favorite podcast app of choice, including iTunes, Stitcher, and now Google Play Music.
We've got a terrific guest on this week's pod. He is the Vice President of Content Distribution North America for Opta, the global sports data provider. He's Angus McNabb. Thanks for joining us today, Gus.
Not a problem. Not a problem at all, Grant.
Great to have you here. We're going to talk soccer analytics and what Opta does. And from time to time, I like to have a good soccer analytics discussion on the podcast, because it's a topic that really interests me. I think it's where the sport is going. And there's a lot of interesting stuff to discuss, but I wanted to start with a very basic question for you. What's the best way to explain what Opta is and what you do in the soccer space?
Yeah, absolutely. It's, I think the real crux of what Opta does is the analysis of matches, the analysis of fixtures. So we're taking in the video of the game, and then we are plotting every single action on the ball with an XY coordinate where it took place. So it's anything from 800 to 1200 actions per team, all done in real time, and it will power the likes of digital experiences, your broadcast, everything that you'll see. A lot of the time, for example, on the Premier League, on Major League Soccer, now on the NASL as well. They're sort of some of our official league partnerships, and they're some of the outputs that we power with the data that's collected.
Okay. And how many countries and leagues are you taking data from?
So there's about 32 competitions at the very top level that we analyze. So you have your sort of big five European leagues. You have, like I said, the MLS and NASL here, but there are a number of other competitions that we cover across the globe that are probably not as popular, or certainly not anywhere near the sort of name recognition here in the US. So things like the Austrian Bundesliga, the leagues up in Sweden, in Denmark, sort of Norway, these kind of competitions there, as well as your South American competitions. And a lot of that information powers, again, the media in their respective domestic markets, but also analytics, scouting for clubs and their search for the best talent really across the globe.
I've actually visited your office before, and it's interesting to me to see the process of how the data is collected. Just to see it's not, I mean, it's a little bit like shoveling coal in some ways, but yeah. it's very work intensive. I mean, you've got a lot to do, and obviously there's more thought going on than shoveling coal, but it's a lot of work.
No, it is. It's an interesting skill set that the guys need. They obviously need the sort of soccer chops and everything that's there, so that player recognition, everything along those lines. But they also need sort of the skill set of a touch typist, have to be very, very fast inputting the data as well, because we are collecting everything in real time. There's a level of post-match checking and correction that goes on, but the core of what we do is live and powering the live experience. So it's a pretty rigorous training process for our analysts. I mean, they'll do well over 60 hours of training before they even get near a live match. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of constantly evolving, and their sort of skill increases the more and more games they do.
Okay. And so where are we sort of in the evolution at this point of soccer analytics? It strikes me that we're pretty early in the game still.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Dean Oliver spoke for us at our Pro Forum back in February in London. And Dean was trying to quantify where soccer sits in the analytics pyramid and how far advanced we are. We're a lot further on than we've ever been. But we're nowhere near the pinnacle of it just yet. I think we compare it to something like the NBA. I think Dean sort of estimated we could possibly be as much as 7 to 10 years behind where sort of the NBA or MLB are now. If you look at teams, probably the best way to see that is a baseball organization in Major League Baseball right now would have an analytics staff getting anything up to 10, 12. Whereas anyone who has a pure data analyst, a data analyst, is sort of still a bit of an anomaly in soccer. It's becoming more the norm, but it's probably more professional clubs don't have than have around the world still.
So I know you work with teams in lots of different leagues, including some of the top teams in the world. What are we talking about as far as like working relationships you have with some of the top clubs?
Yeah, so I think one that's been publicized quite a bit in the last week, and rightly so, is the work that the analytics and scouting department at Leicester City do. They've had a phenomenal job, and I think that there's a lot of credit needs to go actually to the previous manager there in Nigel Pearson. I think if you look at their attitude and the way that analytics has been, and sort of data and analysis has been embraced through the club, one of the really simplest ways that you can see that is probably when you look back on two seasons ago now, the season's over, but 2 seasons ago in the Premier League, and you look at the fact that Nigel Pearson used to sit in the stands for pretty much every first half and would sit next to the guy that has his Mac up and sort of is using sports code and is doing some live tagging, live coding, because he knows that actually his input on the touchline during the first half is minimal. He's given his instruction, he's done everything he can do, but he's there reviewing key elements, key plays next to the video guy in the stand to then go in and really, really enforce change at halftime. And I think that's important to recognise the work that was done of people in sort of setting up and putting a great structure in at the club that's allowed someone else to come in and sort of really further that work in and allow those that are doing a good job to continue doing it.
Now, it strikes me that there's a couple of different ways, probably many different ways to use the data. Like what you're talking about with Pearson there is something that is very sort of rapid response, looking at things, trends in the first half of a game potentially. Yeah. And then there's also the idea of using data to identify players, potential signings, diamonds in the rough from around the world. That's a completely different way of using the data.
Yeah, absolutely.
To start, I guess, how would you use something from like the first half to actually determine what you might say at halftime or what you might change with the team?
So very, very simple things, and we all know it when we watch soccer. Set pieces, massively important. Using the data collection, everything's done. The way it works is that everything created has a timestamp, and that timestamp allows you to go back and access footage at key moments. So you can just flick straight to it, and very quickly he can look and check that every corner. So, for example, whether offensive, defensive, in terms of they can look as has everyone sort of really hit their basic assignments. So men on post, tracking a particular player, that kind of stuff using the time coding. Mm-hmm. And that's very, very quick fixes and things you can address. There's the data side to that as well, where you can also look at things like average formation of a team based on their touches on the ball. Mm-hmm. Teams very much, and you see this on the NASL website as it actually now with the data that we collect for those guys on the NASL this year. You can look at sort of the average formation of a team based on their ball touches live as the game goes. It takes about 15 minutes to have enough data to draw somewhat of a valid conclusion, mm-hmm. but you can look and track that live. So you can very, very quickly see where people are naturally pinching in, for example, on a wing. Okay. Those kind of aspects you can track. And it doesn't have to be something in a very, very long form presentation, but you have something there that's a visual cue to a player. Mm-hmm. You can show him an image, show him something very, very quickly and say, right, there we go. There's something for you to look at. Another example in live is we have something where we look at pass combinations between players. Mm-hmm. So you won't necessarily have to, there'll be a player who's not necessarily looking at the fact that he has the most passes on the team. That's great. That's fine in terms of that information. But you can look at where they go most frequently. So you can look at his most common outlet. So you might not necessarily shut that player down to stop him receiving the ball, mm-hmm. but you might actually try and block off his outlet pass more often. So you create unnatural thought and he's probably more prone to a launch and putting the ball up the park, mm-hmm. Where you've got a better chance of regaining possession. So there are a lot of things that can be looked at and looked at in a live environment. In the coaching, scouting world, very, very different to sort of here with US sport. It's a global game. Yeah. And the best talent isn't within sort of this country. You've got to go elsewhere. With that, there are market inefficiencies, and data certainly helps you to look and scout. And it doesn't, and this is probably one of the big misconceptions of it, people don't just operate on data. The old style of coaching is there, and scouting and everything exists, but it helps and gets you to a place quicker. And more efficiently on your spend, because sending a coach to Norway for a week to look for players in the old days, go there for 2 weeks, watch 3 games, watch 5 games. Well, that's great, but that's an absolute roll of the dice. Mm-hmm. Here you're going with a very filtered, defined shortlist to look, to then gauge, speak to coaches, get some of the personal, the qualitative factors that go into a decision in, is this the right player for you? But your data side of it can help with that shortlisting process greatly.
Okay, interesting. And you can customize that kind of search, right, for what a coach or a sporting director may be looking for as far as attributes are concerned, and then have a search for through all the leagues that you service.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the way it really should work, is that the coach, the GM, in terms of when they define their style, their philosophy, or even just gaps in current performance, you should be recruiting to address a need, mm-hmm. and not just blanket. It's interesting that the questions and things have been debated this week on discovery rights, mm-hmm. and things like that in the MLS and discovering Zlatan. Well, yeah, that's not the greatest sort of discovery in the world, but you could find sort of other players that are seeing existing in French League 2, mm-hmm. who are sort of genuine discovery and sort of uncover really a real diamond in the rough there.
Riyad Mahrez from French League 2, as I recall.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, another great bit of business by Leicester City.
So tell me a little bit about specifically what you're doing with MLS and NASL that would interest our listeners.
Well, the MLS, and I've sort of come to this country 3.5-4 years ago in my work with Opta, and the MLS continues to surprise me in a massively positive way. Mm. The single entity system has some great advantages in the recruitment, scouting, And the way that the league approaches things, it is pretty unique in world football. We work with the league and we work with the CPN department, the Central Player Network, and everyone that's in that department looking at recruitment, scouting. And they take data from a number of competitions in South America to help teams with their decision making. And they also have a service with us and with our data analysts where teams are allocated a number of reports per season, and we can go in and provide evaluation on a specific player and rate him against someone that they may have in their current squad, the league average in that particular position, against another player that they might be considering for investment for a transfer as well. So that, as a central service, is pretty unique to any of the leagues across the globe. It's normally left on the clubs to do this. And the league's taking this on board with MLS 3 years ago was a massive positive and has really, really driven the need for sort of real quality work in research and recruitment and scouting and justifying your decisions. Sport is a business. Like any business, you do your due diligence on an asset, on an investment. And this is a really, really good way to sort of make sure that it's really sort of a rising tide, really lifting all boats. And it's done a great job in doing that in the initial sort of phase. We also do a lot of work with teams individually as well. We work with probably around sort of three quarters of the MLS teams now over and beyond the sort of central services to assist them in their recruitment, scouting, and everything that's there. And that ranges from very, very simple things in live data, in the presentation of live data, to some teams that are really, really looking now and doing the global search that for us probably is when I joined Opta in 2011, I think you could count on one hand the number of professional soccer clubs around the world who were contracting us specifically for professional team services. That's now sort of into probably well over 100, 150. On the professional soccer side and the rugby world where I came from previously and worked with Opta in the UK, that was something that was probably a little bit further on in the majority of teams, leagues were using our data and our analysis there. And it's really, really just continued to grow and grow really here.
Interesting. I mean, I find it fascinating that the single entity system is, in your opinion, it sounds like a positive thing for MLS as far as something like this?
Yeah, it certainly has been. And not only on the recruitment side, we do a lot of work with Jeff Agus and the competitions committee on looking at product quality. Because we have this data set from around the world, we're able to say, actually, where are we on our sort of mission to get to elite status by 2022? We're able to, and we produce reports for ownership, for senior leadership at the MLS on where they sit for various categories in product quality, looking specifically at on-field performance. And certainly we can see year on year that the league is becoming more exciting, the attacking threat at the top end of the pitch. It's very, very positive, and it's something that's very, very, it's a smart goal. It's specific, it's measurable, it's attainable, it's realistic, and ultimately it's trackable, which is the key thing with us.
You think it's realistic? I mean, the whole 2022 thing, based on what you're seeing from a data perspective.
I think absolutely. When you look at the investment and what they're doing with players, and you look at the quality of player that's coming into the league, the product quality on the field is rising. Rising. You can't, when you look at someone like Sebastian Giovinco, and you look at his numbers across last season, across this season so far as well, there's no other way to describe that as world class. Now, again, when people are recruiting and they will look at bias and quality of a competition and apply a rating to a competition when they recruit to look at player strength. But someone like the MLS is well up on that sort of list and marks from where it once was. It is a quality competition that people really rate certain attributes on players and things like that. And it's not the traditional, it's rather old school view of American players. They're great, they're fit. In terms of it, there are some real sort of elements of skill and sort of we've seen some real improvement in the league over the last number of years.
Okay. Now, over time, I've spoken to various people in soccer analytics, and what they've often said to me is a lot of clubs, leagues are using data now, but there still aren't that many that are kind of all in or really the manager or the sporting director, the people in charge, trust it.
Yeah.
Or even want to use it. Like, what are some of the teams, both in MLS and maybe in England, say, that you've encountered who actually really appear to be using the stuff?
So Toronto are doing a good job here. Toronto are doing a very good job here in the US. And it's no sort of secret, I'll say them, because Devin Plouer, who's their sort of manager of analytics, director of analytics up there, Devin used to work for us at Opta and then went to Toronto. So we're obviously a big fan of his. He's a good, very good friend of mine. But the, some of the things that they're doing there are very, very good in the way that they're preparing scouting reports, establishing a workflow with the coaching staff to deliver information at the right times. A lot of things with analytics, and where you've seen cases where it's not worked in a club or an organization, is because they've not defined roles, they've not defined a workflow, they've not defined when a coach is going to get something. I think if you just say, we're going down an analytics route, it's like, well, what does that mean for my organization? You have to very, very clearly define roles, define process, and look at what analytics is going to deliver you. So if it's actually we're going to work behind the scenes and work on recruitment and provide a list to our scouts, that's great. If it's we're going to actually go into detail and look at our next opponent and it's going to be an opposition analysis and things we can do there, again, that's fine. If it's actually we're just going to reflect on our own performance and see where we could be better, again, that's fine. But I think you just have to have very clear conversations and look at where people are within the organization, and people will accept it if it's built into their day-to-day duties and it's not a chore and it delivers something of real value. I think the most successful clubs do that and do it very, very well.
I wanted to ask you about a term that we're hearing more and more in media discussion of soccer is expected goals. And I guess just to start, what are expected goals?
So expected goals is if you look at the a chance that's created and a shot resulting from that chance, what is the expectation that the player will score? Mm-hmm. So putting a probability on a shot is essentially what an expected goal is. There are a number of things that go into that. So the pattern of play, was it a fast break? Was it sort of a set piece? All of these aspects that go into it. And then you look at things like where the shot was from, where the goalkeeper was stood, where the shot was going to. And so you've got a before and an after value, really. So you can have, we look at expected goals, but we also look at expected goals on target as well, because that's probably a truer reflection as well in looking at a model and building it. And I can't lay claim that I'm the one that sits in a shed at Opta and does all this work. We have a brilliant data scientist and team of data scientists that's growing, doing all of that work, building all of those models. And I think a lot of the things that I now do is sit and build relationships with coaches, and it, not necessarily explain it. These guys get it in terms of, but it's sort of how that can be useful to them. So looking at the chances that a team are creating. So there are some very, very simple things where you can look at expected goals and how many should we score. You can also flip the model and look at expected goals against as well. Mm-hmm. And look at sort of the number of chances and the quality of chances you're allowing your opposition to have as well.
We do seem to be having a debate that's sort of similar, and I smile about this, to Joe Morgan in baseball having an issue with analytics in that sport. And this came up in a recent Craig Berley versus Gabriel Marcotti discussion on ESPN FC about expected goals. Why is there some controversy over this, I guess?
It's like anything new. Anything new is treated with suspicion, and that's it. So, and it's also, you look at the age of players and things like that, and this isn't meant to be a dig at Craig Berley, but he's quite a while away from playing. Whereas you look at the work someone like Jamie Carragher, Gary Neville are doing in the UK, they're players who grew up with analytics and sort of at the forefront of it. I mean, Manchester United, in terms of Sir Alex Ferguson, if there was any advantage to be taken, he would use it. So Gary Neville will be useful with presentations of data, of numbers, and he's taken that onto his role with Sky in the UK. Jamie Carragher would have been there in the Damien Comolli years at Liverpool, mm-hmm. and will be used to have seen data to present and sort of give information. Brendan Rodgers, again, used data analysis a lot when he was at Reading and at Swansea as well in his preparation. So you have a group of players now who are going into the media who are more familiar with these terms and want to use them because actually it gives them some competitive advantage over some of the older guys, really. And a point of difference. And I think having a debate on it and its merits, and actually it's the league table that counts, there's some truth in that in terms of because people are hired and fired based on what a league table says. But I think the having a genuine debate on it rather than a shouting match is certainly far healthier for it and a much better place to be.
Imagine that.
I know, exactly.
I wanted to ask you about, we mentioned before we came on here, a specific thing involving expected goals and Chicago Fire. And is there some light you can shed on maybe what they're doing with some of the moves they've made recently connected to their expected goal situation?
Yeah, I think that they are struggling for goals in terms of when we look at expected goals and things like that, we exclude penalties and we exclude those kind of factors in there. I think a penalty sits at around about 70% sort of success rate, something yeah. around there. So where we exclude those factors and we look at sort of number of on-target shots, number of total shots, and then we look at sort of expected goals. Chicago Fire have only had sort of 21 on-target shots this season so far. And that is significantly lower than anyone else in the competition this year. So going out and recruiting sort of someone at the top end of the pitch who's proven in the Eredivisie is a great move for them. They are slightly behind their expected goals on target. They've scored 8, and their expected goals on target, our model puts them at about 10.19 for that particular metric. And they needed to go and do something. And I think that's where a GM like Nelson will very much take on board sort of the data, the numbers, what are things telling him, and work with his head coach to say, okay, this is an area where we can look and try and find some help here. You've got the flip side of that, and you look at someone like the Whitecaps at the moment in terms of, I think we've got 19 goals when we look at things there, again, I believe excluding non-penalty goals and things mm-hmm. like that. But their expected goals on target is actually showing them that they're underperforming still quite a bit, but still with sort of 19 goals, they're up there in the league charts. Their expected goals on target shows that they should be around sort of 25.48, something around that mark. So they're a very, very different situation. So you've got a team there in Vancouver who actually we're doing quite well. We're sort of up towards the top end of the league. We're certainly happy with where we are. But actually, the underlying might be there that there's more to come from them as well, okay. Versus someone like Chicago, where it's an underperformance, and actually we need to do something to redress this.
And so the signing of Michael DeLeo by Chicago recently here, a pretty clear response to their situation.
I think so. I think all teams will look to improve their roster at various points during the year. It's a natural time for MLS clubs to look, and I think they've picked a player who's proven in a very solid European competition in the Eredivisie, and I would fully expect him to do well and perform well when he sort of lands in Chicago in the next couple of weeks.
I wanted to ask you about an event that took place fairly recently at Columbia University that you did, and I think it was involving MLS teams, correct? Or at least trying to put together an MLS team using data?
Yeah, so I've been a sort of guest visiting lecturer up at Columbia since January of this year. And as part of their master's in sports management, they sort of went and spoke to the sports business community. And there was a real desire for the course to have much more analytical components. So be that on the ticketing, revenue side of the business, but also on the sort of real looking at recruitment, strategy, everything like that, who went into player personnel departments. So we've worked with the university and devised the course with them there. And the final task of sort of the module that I was taking and teaching on the analytics of global sport, the task was to use the publicly available information from the Players Association in player salaries and our Opta data to power and pull together what a MLS roster could, or perhaps even some would say should, look like based on performance from the last 3 years of data. And it was a really interesting process because there were varying levels of soccer intelligence within all of the groups that were taking part in the competition. And they were looking at some pretty serious mathematical regressions in the data and some interesting things, taking sort of theory from the business world and portfolio theory and looking at what your spread of risk should be in your squad. So how many flyers could you realistically take on sort of players that you were, they were high risk, high reward kind of things, and all of these elements to devise a roster. And it was interesting. We put it out there. There was an article that went up on MLSsoccer.com as well, and it got some really, really interesting comments and replies. This was something that was done purely on the analytics side. And so there was the usual comments on the message board, like, so this is a joke. There's no team. There's no players from either the Timbers or the Crew in here, and they were the MLS Cup finalists. And, yeah, there might not be, because it was looking really at some ways at a value play in terms of where can we find sort of value or market inefficiency within our own league? Where are some of the guys that really stand out as really give standout performance and really value for money? There's an article on the Opta Pro blog right now from one of the students who took part in the competition, James Appel, on their sort of process in getting to their selection, which is quite interesting for anyone who's into their analytics, their numbers and everything there. But it was a really interesting process to go through and to see the feedback from it as well.
Did any players stand out as far as MLS players with high value?
I think
surprises.
There was some players that our analysts and guys in the office have always liked. So the way our analysis worked here in with the guys that when we were analyzing in New York was the guys would get a team and that would be their team for the year. So they would be very fond of a particular player. It would develop that way. And so the guys that had Chicago had said for a number of years that David Akam was, in terms of incredibly good value DP. And when people were looking at sort of putting a valuation on him and his inclusion, he appeared in quite a lot of rosters as a pretty significant value pick. And that was certainly interesting. It was an interesting one. It was very, very interesting because people weren't certain, and there was a couple of things on players potentially playing out of position, but actually when they came to the league and started, that was their sort of given stroke designated role, and so they were in our database in a particular position. Now when we do the week-to-week formations, they'll be different, but the core database, their position had maybe shifted a bit from where they had started, so there was accusations of picking people who were out of position and all of these elements.
Because Jurgen Klinsmann, you're a virtual coach.
Well, oh, controversial. No. It was interesting. It was very, very interesting. I think there's that argument as well, picking people for a system. And that was it. The quality of the work, the quality of the research was brilliant for a week. And the week that the students had to pull this together. They were sort of identifying playing style within all the teams and everything like that, in addition to selecting this. So they were saying, right, how do certain teams play? Are they possession-based? Are they counter-attacking-based? Are they more balanced? And then looking at player fit within that. It was a really, really great process to be involved with and thoroughly enjoyed the work that we've done with Columbia this year.
Nice. I have to ask this question. It may be a yes or no answer from your end. Is it possible to use data to find the opposite of David Akam? Like, we had this debate here, is Frank Lampard the worst signing in MLS history? Would there be a way to compare Frank Lampard to Rafa Márquez? Because we aren't quite sure which is the worst.
It's one of those interesting things with data. You can always use data to make your point. And if you looked at something on a per-minute basis, I'm not sure Miss Lampard would fare too favorably. If you looked at per-minute and salary, something like that. Listen, you can do that. That's probably one of the real things that we've not struck on, is that data in terms of in your reporting of it and the way it's represented and the way data is represented and how big a sample size is to draw valid conclusions is a real key point. And you can joke on it and people can look at player A versus player B. But there are other circumstances that go into it.
Yeah.
And it's why that sort of point we made on we're not replacing traditional scouting exists,
right.
Is that you can always do these things, but you need to sort of check back and look at sort of underlying factors and things that existed. I think when you look at Frank Lampard's injury record throughout his career, he's not really suffered particularly with any sort of injuries or anything like that. It's just been incredibly unfortunate.
Yeah.
It's just been incredibly unfortunate. I think it looks like he's going to get back out on the field in sort of the coming sort of week or so.
Yeah.
And I think it'd be great that he does. I think when he does get back out there, I think it'll be very, very interesting. The spotlight will be on him and people will be looking at things. I think Andrea Pirlo came in for quite a bit of stick in terms of as well when he first came to the league. But I remember early part of this year, the game he played against Toronto, he had most touches of any MLS player in a game so far this season at that point. And becoming more and more involved. And we had a little chat on the elevator away up to the office in terms of setting up things in an expansion team is tough.
Yeah.
And an expansion project is a tough one. And particularly when you bring in people mid-year and things on that, it takes time. And I think the work that NYCFC are doing and the work that has been done over the sort of the period, they'll start to see it. I think Orlando as well. Not huge changes in the off-season particularly, but both teams certainly look like second-year, not first-year teams anymore, and massively improving.
We're about a third of the way through the MLS regular season at this point. Are there any other things that have stood out to you about particular players or teams this season?
Yeah, I think so. I think the Red Bulls, in terms of you look at things there, and if we're speaking about particular players and expected goals, Bradley Wright Phillips is having a little bit of a tough time of it in terms of he scored 3 goals or sort of not again sort of taking that sort of penalties and things like that out the equation again. And he actually has an expected goals on target of about 8.77 at this point. And so he's getting in the right positions. Those chances are falling to him. He's still doing a great job. And I think that's just sort of that classic thing of how can you measure luck? Well,
yeah.
Expected goals to a degree, it can't completely measure luck, but it can show you that a player is getting himself in the right position, and I think that'll change for him pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I know you're working with the NASL as well. Anything standing out there?
I think the big thing from the NASL that we saw, and it was interesting, Commissioner Peterson actually said it to us and said it to the press guys and things as well. Once we started to get involved in there and the data being on the website and everything that existed for them, he was massively surprised by the response in terms of didn't quite realize that the fanaticism of the fans that exists for looking into the minutiae of the detail and exploring things in our chalkboards, in our sort of widgets that exist in their match center now. And I think that's a general trend that I've noticed coming to the States as well. It's a young soccer country in a lot of ways, but the fanatical element in terms of, as opposed to casual observer or just fan, the fanatical element really do seek out soccer content and look in places to sort of explore it, be it sort of on MLS Reddit or NASL Reddit boards and things like that. I think for me as an outsider coming into the country, where soccer is and its sort of standing within the US, massively sort of surprising, and it's just rising up that pyramid of importance and sort of public consciousness day in, day out. I think this summer will be fantastic with Copa, and then I think when the Copa boom dies down, I think the really great thing for the US is and for soccer in America is you've got a women's team going to the Olympics with absolutely every chance of taking gold again.
And you work with women's team as well?
We've done a lot of work, and we did a huge amount of work with Fox last year on the Women's World Cup. And it was one of the most enjoyable projects I think I ever had the pleasure of working on with some of their guys behind the scenes. Mark Young, who now makes it onto air every now and then and is the maestro behind permutations on drawers and, yeah. and everything else that exists there. We did a lot with Mark and his research team there at Fox and on sort of some of the storytelling around performance at the Women's World Cup.
Okay.
And it was really important for Fox that it was done and treated in the exact same way as the men's game would be, and rightly so. So we really delved into looking at key things. I remember, I think it was for the quarterfinal, when sort of Holiday and Rapinoe were suspended in terms of looking at their importance and where they had sort of sat within the team structure for the US women's team and really using data to tell that story. And other elements like Germany's thrashing of, I can't remember who it was in the group stage, but doing very cool things like mapping out all of their shots on the virtual pitch and things like that. They really, really did a phenomenal job, and I was delighted when they picked up a sports Emmy last week as well.
Nice. I guess moving forward, I was curious to know, where do you see soccer analytics going from here? What comes next?
It's interesting. You've got the sort of Brentfords of this world, Michelins and things like that in Europe, who very, very publicly nailed their colours to the mast and used it. It's like any sport. Competitive advantage is key, is crucial. And I think within the MLS, where you're in a salary capped system, you can develop huge competitive advantage in support and in an infrastructure within your club. And analytics is a key part of that. So whether it's something as simple on the performance side as you might, in terms of if you're a team, look to stay in the same hotel chain and take bedding for every player. So because you're doing that much time on the road, they've got a common sort of feel and it feels like the same bed that they're staying in. And you can do something as simple as that. Team Sky do that in cycling with David Brailsford and his whole philosophy of marginal gains and everything that you can do to gain competitive advantage. You've got sort of things on the physiological side and anatomy, physiology, things that sit there. And analytics and data will fit very much into that sphere and looking at where you can get marginal gains. I think here within the MLS, some teams do an absolutely great job of it on the performance side and sort of the data analysis side. Seattle have a phenomenal guy in Ravi across there who does a great job with our data and also all of their GPS and training data to look at load and injury management and things that exist there. Colorado do a great job in their recruitment and scouting and do a lot of work with us on taking information from competitions across the globe. I think when you're in a salary capped environment like MLS is, and very specifically analytics here in this country, you can gain huge competitive advantage. And I only see it on a very, very sharp upward trajectory in the next few years.
Nice. Well, Angus McNabb, really enjoyed the discussion. Really appreciate you coming into the studio here. Thanks so much for joining the podcast.
Not a problem. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much to Angus McNabb for the time. That'll do it for us this week on the Planet Football Podcast. Again, if you have not yet, please follow our Facebook page or like our Facebook page, Sports Illustrated Planet Football. A lot of good things coming, a lot of big things next week, in fact. And that is a tease that I'm not going to get into more about at all, but you'll definitely want to be on board for all of that. So again, thank you to Grant Wall and Brian Strauss for joining us. Our producer is Alex Abnos. I am Avi Krediter. We'll talk to you next week on the Planet Football Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.